Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel speeding in!
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
That sounds about right. Off the record is always on the record.
And speaking of on the record, it's another show of The Suspendables with a very highly produced introduction there. We've been off for a week, but I missed you, Rusty. I missed
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, pal.
And, Let me tell people before we bring on our guest, Russ, let me tell really people how effed up you are, Russ. Okay. Okay. So we've been doing this show and we said we weren't going to swear. So we've done it once or twice already.
Yeah.
So I'll tell my guests, Russ and I have done this show. Well, we've done well over 100 shows. And every time we do the show, Wiz, we have to stop down because of that noise right there. You hear the White Claw being opened. And Russ has this giant ice maker, okay, that is constantly producing ice because he rips through a case of wine every 3 hours, okay, and he has spritzers and he needs this ice and it's really annoying, okay. So we always go, Russ, stop, unplug the ice maker, Russ, okay, we're trying to do a show, okay. He always forgets and says, I can't hear it. Today we start the show and Russ comes on completely annoyed with saying, there's a dripping tap in the background. Okay, it's bothering me. What is wrong with you, Cordell?
Leaky condo.
We're off last week, 2 weeks ago, and I got busted, and I'm afraid this guy might bust me too. So we had Brian Leach on, great guy, wonderful man. And I'm a bullshitter, and I said, you know, we've been trying for a long time to get this guest, and we finally got him, and he came on and said, no, you haven't tried to get me on. I've never heard from you. I'm like really impressed, Jimmy, that you went over 100 shows. But this guy I have been trying to get on. He's one of my all-time favorites. An absolute rock star. You know, he's over 1,000 games, over 1,000 points in the NHL, 22-year career. But all that shit aside, he likes to gamble, likes to drink. You know, he likes to party. He's a scratch or better golfer. You know, he's got a beautiful family. Just his life is like one big beer commercial. And of course, I'm talking about Ray Whitney. How are you, Wizard? Nice to have you on, baby.
Wiz.
Well, it's very nice of you. And thanks for getting me on there after 100 shows, too. I appreciate it finally getting on here. But to your credit, yes, you have been trying to get me on. And for whatever reason, I like to pretend I'm too busy, but really I'm not.
Yeah, it's like Russ, you know, no, I'm really busy, Jimmy. I'm here and there and I'm doing this and that and the other thing. And then next thing you know, he made $4 million and we don't know how he did it. You know, it's
Wiz is working hard. I can attest to that.
Let's catch up, Ray. Rusty, I interviewed Ray way back when, I don't know, we got to know each other through Gretz, like a lot of my entire life. And, so we brought him on the morning show in Ottawa with Stevie and myself and JR. And I'm whipping through his stats. Wiz, I've never been a guy to let facts get in the way of a good story. Okay. And I'm looking through, I go, yeah, okay, Junior Spokane. 189 or 85 points 1 year in Spokane. I said,
unreal.
Got to be a misprint. And it wasn't. And when I said to him, holy man, Ray, 185 or 89 points. How did you pull that off? He said, well, I was really good. I said, this guy's the best.
I do remember that conversation. And I think I even had the arrogance to follow up. The only difference between me and 99 right now is that he gets more ice time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. What are you doing these days, Ray? Are you working for the NHL? That was the last time I heard something about you, an update. What's happening with your life?
Yeah, I'm still working for the Department of Player Safety. I work with underneath George Parros and alongside Stefan Quintel, Damian Archieveta, and Patrick Burke. So we got that great job where half the league loves you one night and half the league hates you, and it's vice versa the next night. So it's a thick skin job, but it's a job with the National Hockey League, and it's inside the inside the game still, and you see all the players, you know all the players, and it just keeps you active in the game.
How does it work, Ray? When there were lots of them, it seems it was pretty active. The year itself, and then the playoffs with suspensions. Walk us through that. With take us through one of them. Give us an example of what you guys do and how you manage it.
Well, it's an interesting process, especially when I didn't know how it worked either, even after playing so long. But we have 9 coordinators in New York watching the games on both the live or the home and away feeds. And we have either Damian, George, or Patrick in the office with them. And when a video comes up or a hit or an injury or anything along those lines, they cut it. They ask them if they should send it out to the rest of us. And when they send it out to us, you know, I can do it from anywhere, basically. So it's mobile. I get it on my iPad, my phone, or my computer. And I just look at the clip and I look at all the angles. And then if George Parros decides he wants to, go a little further on the line of it, if he doesn't like it, he'll send out an email which says thoughts. And then I got to write an email and just say, what I think of this play and whether I think there's supplemental discipline coming. And he makes the decision and the final decision of whether we're going to have a hearing or not. And typically that hearing is the next day. And so you got to be on call basically the entire season at any time. And then the next day we go into that hearing, we hear from the player, we hear from the GM, we hear from the agent, the Players Association then speaks. And then George speaks and our side goes on. And then once that's done, we'll get off and the 5 of us will get back on a call for ourselves, and we'll deliberate and we'll hash it out and we'll decide whether we're going to suspend or not. And a lot of times it doesn't matter what the numbers are for or against. It's George in the end makes the final decision. So, he relies on our opinions, obviously, but if he's very strong on some, he'll still go his route. And he has to deal with the general manager on the call the next day too.
Mm-hmm. Why the agent? Why is the agent involved?
Well, the agent gets on there for a character reference, right? He's there to tell us how great the player is and how well he's loved in the community and
shocker,
how this would never happen kind of play. And,
best guy ever.
Yeah. And that's kind of how it is. And, a lot of times we hear a lot of the same agent because he's, he's got a good stable of clients. And a lot of times it's the same agent because it's the same guy on the call. So we can, when you get to the 5th or 6th time you're suspending the guy, it's pretty hard for the agent to get on there and keep defending his character. But a lot of times it's not attacking their character at all. Anyway, it's just the game of hockey and how it goes.
Yeah. It's the right play. It's great that they have so many of you that played the game that help make the decision. I like that. I've always said that the players know best, and so it's great that there's so many of you involved in that decision.
Yeah, you have George, right, who was he played a little tougher style of a game, and he has fair fights. And then Stefan Quintel was the same. He was a pretty strong defenseman who wasn't afraid to fight either. And then you get me in there, who I dropped my gloves once in my career, and Dave Stewart got so disgusted that he gave us a double minor for roughing. So any other referee in today's game, I would have got my 5 for fighting. But all we did was start up a shitstorm with Marty McSorley, Tockett, Owen Nolan, Jim Kite. I mean, all the big boys came in, and we started a 5-on-5, and it was Robert Lang and I. You're a real couple heavyweights. We're going to get after it. And I remember Stewie, he pokes his head into the penalty box. He was so disgusted. He told me to F off. You just started that whole shit show. I'm only giving you a double minor. And I was begging him to give me 5.
That's so good.
But you made it through the game. Did you?
I made it through the game alive, though. I didn't get beat up, so that was good.
Yeah, but yeah. What a great idea by the league to have the variety of players from different angles, because you weren't a fighter. And then the other two, like I'd say, Quintel was the middle road. He wasn't a tough guy per se. He was tough, but he wasn't out there. He was a good player and was out there trying to play the game. And then Parros was a tough guy. So you've got, different angles from different style players. So I think it's great.
Yeah, it really is a pretty good diversity in there. And people might be surprised, actually, though. The guy who who got the least amount of penalty minutes. I'm probably the guy who defends the players more often than not. And I'm the guy who calls for suspensions probably least than anyone. So at one point the guys were asking, what the hell does a guy have to do for me to want to suspend him? And my onus, guys, is a guy who had the puck a lot, who got hit a lot, and never once really got hit like these guys are getting hit today. So I put a lot of onus on the player who's going to get hit and being able to know your surroundings, know who you're on the ice with, and being able to protect yourself. So I don't give a lot of leniency to the guys who get hit a lot of times, because sometimes it's just, you know, in my eyes, it's on them. And I lose that battle quite often, but, you know, that's just how I played the game. And you look at some, I got a great quote for you. I said, guys, I never once got hit like that in my entire career. Except I got hit by a player who was a lot smarter than me, and that was Peter Forsberg. Oh. And this wasn't too long after we played together in the All-Star game. We're in the Pepsi Center. I'm playing. I go up the left wing, and it's a 3-on-3, and I see he's got his guy. So I'm going to cut to the middle like 99 does, because that's my idol. And he knew I was going to do that from the red line. So when I cut to the middle, there was Peter Forsberg, and I was on my ass looking at the top of the Pepsi Center. Man, because the only time I got hit that hard open ice. And again, like I said, it was from a guy who was just a better player than me. So these guys nowadays, I don't have a lot of leniency for them getting hit when they should have a better knowledge of their surroundings.
So that's interesting. What was the big one where the guy grabbed the guy by the hair? What was that poor fiasco that you guys had to suss out? Ray just put the mic down and walked away and said, no, we're not.
it was a situation where a player was trying to pull him out of the pile. And it was Graves, I believe, in Colorado. He had long hair. And I think he was just trying to rip his helmet off and got a handful of hair at the same time. And, we rely a little bit then. You rely on the referees who are in the fight or down on the ice level. They're in there as well. And, they could hear him yelling and screaming that he had hold of his hair. And then obviously the big clump of hair on the ice is a pretty good giveaway. Yeah. So I'm not necessarily saying he's intentionally grabbing his hair, but when you have a fistful of hair and a guy screaming, you probably should let it go.
Right. Right. Before we have some fun, I want to find out some fun stories about you and the NHL and all the fun shit you do, which is great. Player safety. There's a lot of people, you know, the concussion protocol wizard that's been out there. They're talking about trying to, you know, make it safer. They're doing, the league's doing more and more to try and ensure that players are safe on the ice. And yet some are coming up going, well, they're talking about the concussion problems and they want to avoid some of that. And yet they're still going to allow fighting. I want to ask you about that, Ray. What do you say to all that? If you want to stop concussions, stop freaking fighting, sort of deal.
Well, I'd say the amount of concussions you get from fighting is very limited. I don't see that being the reason guys are getting concussed. And Kelly Chase, we were talking about that the other day up here. You know, Chase has had 300 and some fights, and he can honestly say that he got knocked out or had a concussion maybe twice in his career from fighting. But he's had more concussions just from body contact than he ever did from fighting. Now that number may be higher than two. He might be exaggerating in that, but he felt that even out of all the fights he had, he got more concussions, from being body checked. And I think with concussions, when your head hits the boards or you get whiplash, it's the fact that your brain whacks off the side of your skull. I think everybody knows how a concussion operates, but I feel like hitting is where you get more concussions than you do just from the fighting. And for me personally, and this is my own opinion, I'm not saying this is the National Hockey League's opinion in any way, and I don't want to get myself or anybody in trouble, but I think fighting is an important part of our game. I think it's still a...
Attaboy, Ray.
Fans like to see it. Players like to be able to police it once in a while. It's if you have no way to protect yourself or have any repercussions on what you do out there, I think the game then gets even more out of hand with the body contact and the stick work. So I think if there's a little bit of fear that you may have to answer the bell to somebody for your actions, I think it helps keep players in check. But as for concussions, the league's doing an amazing job, I think, in controlling when a player can still play after he's been hit. And, you know, if a player grabs his head after he's been hit hard or hit open ice and he stays down and, you know, and we see all the video of them on the bench, and we have our spotters, and our spotters do an amazing job, I think, of making sure the guys have to be pulled and go through the concussion protocol before they're allowed to continue to play. And that's something that didn't happen in the past. And Russ, I'm sure you knew this. I played a few periods or remainders of games where I didn't quite remember all of it and was a little foggy. And I think the league's doing a great job right now of limiting that as best that they can. I mean, guys can still fake it and hide it. But I think they're doing a really good job of trying to control it. But it is a big issue, obviously.
100% agree with you, Ray. And now it keeps guys in check. If they know they got to answer to somebody who's a good fighter, you know, they're not going to run around with their heads cut off. And
well, I'll give you another example of that, Russ, too, as you see what's just happened in the offseason. You know, obviously right now, Tom Wilson's one of our, you know, the public enemy to other teams. He's public enemy number one to a lot of teams out there for how big and how, you know, how he plays. He plays a great style of game, in my opinion. It's just sometimes he gets, you know, with his body size and the speed that he can play the game, it puts him in some tough spots. But, you know, the New York Rangers debacle that they had with, you know, with Panarin and Buchnevich and the whole whole thing. Well, what did the New York Rangers do this offseason? They went and got the toughest guy in the league now in Ryan Reeves. And was that a move to alleviate a little bit of Wilson when they play? I don't know. You can't say for sure, but it certainly looks like they have adjusted their lineup to be able to handle a team that they have to play five or six times a year.
And the Rangers were just taken over by a kid who played the game and knows the game very well. And first move is to go there and get some heavy players that are going to look after the guys like Panarin. So I thought it was a great move.
It certainly made sense for sure.
Yeah, it does.
And it's true. I've never been to a game where, you know, a fight breaks on, everyone goes, oh my God, everyone turn their back. You know, I can't watch this.
And it's funny you say that, Jim. I was just sitting there last weekend with a guy named Patrick Weitzel. And I don't know if anybody knows who Patrick is, but he's one of the guys who bought the UFC and him and his company. And we were just talking about hockey and fighting, and you know, UFC is one of the biggest revenue sports there is in the world. Not even just here; it's starting to become a world thing. And say you have 12 fights a night, there's 12 guys getting knocked out pretty much guaranteed. And I would say half the winners probably have a slight concussion as well from all the belts they take. But he made a good point. He goes, they should be incorporating some more using the fighting because we're the only sport who can do it, as another advantage to take our sport to another level. And I'm not sure the National Hockey League wants that. I'm not suggesting that. It was just a different take and an interesting take from a guy who owns the number one selling or revenue generated sport. I don't know if it's over football or not, but he says they're doing quite well. So it's interesting. Fighting is always a topic for us, but I certainly think there's room for it in our game.
Well, when we moved from Minnesota to Dallas, the hockey team, and the first year, Shane Sherla was the most popular player on the team, and that's including Mike Modano. I mean, Charles was like a rock star because he'd run around and smoke guys and then drop the gloves if he had to. But they just, Dallas loved him so much because of the way he played. And then, of course, they started learning the game. And they fell in love with Mo because he's such a gifted, great player. And they started seeing that side of the game. But initially, what they really, really loved was Shane Cherla running around hitting guys and then dropping the gloves. He was a freaking rock star right off in the first couple months we were there.
I think that happens in a lot of those, Russ. You know, I was a part of the expansion team in San Jose when they first came into the league. And you know, Link Gates was the number one guy there for a couple of years just because they couldn't believe this was happening and allowed to have these bare knuckle fights. You know, he's fighting Probert and those fights aren't lasting 20 seconds. Those are a minute and a half, 2 minute rounds. And, it kind of astonishes people at first. And then you see Ryan Reeves go to Vegas and, he was another fan favorite right there. So you're right in saying that. I'm not sure what the Seattle Kraken are going to do, if they're going to bring one of those guys in or not, but it certainly brings excitement.
Mm-hmm. Well, it can't be a fun job.
It's not for the guys who don't like it. It is for the guys who like it. The guys that the tough guy that isn't really, he doesn't want to be that guy. It's a brutal job. because there's no way around it, but there's players out there that absolutely thrive on it and they love it. But that poor guy that's big, strong, and can fight, it's the worst job because now he's stuck. He's got to do it to stay in the league. And we've seen what has happened to some of those players with drugs and alcohol and, mm-hmm. and that was because they didn't like what they were doing a lot of the times and they suffered. It was terrible. We've heard stories of guys couldn't sleep the night before the game because they knew who they had to face the next day. And
that'd be when you freaking suckered Messier and that was
months.
Yeah. You know, what's coming next, right? Yeah. Yeah. I get it. And I don't want to be a guy who didn't fight saying it should be. I don't think those stage fights, you know, like, hey, we're just going to fight for the sake of fighting should be allowed anymore. But
no,
I just like that you run over, you know, the best player, you run over Connor McDavid, you know, with a hard hit and or do something, or you keep going after him, that you should have to, you know, they should be able to handle it a little bit and you know, that sort of nature. But I certainly don't enjoy or don't think there's any room anymore for those two heavyweights to just come on for 4 or 5 minutes a night and they just step over and just fight for the sake of fighting. And I think the league's done a good job of eliminating that. And you're right, Russ, you know, like when you do something to somebody and you have to pay the price coming up in a few games, that weighs on your mind. And mm-hmm. I got it from a different point. I wasn't from a fight. I actually I got Zdeno Chara once and I put him on the highlights, you know, with the old between the legs move. And he had just won a Norris the year before. And Aaron Ward was playing with him and I played with him in the previous year. And he calls me after and he goes, oh boy. He goes, the next couple of weeks, he didn't play very well. He's been rattled since he's been on the highlights and he's been mad. And he goes, just a heads up for when you play him next. And my goodness, it was rough.
Zdeno Chara and Ray Whitney. Oh my God.
So the funniest part was he was cross-checking me.
Did you lift him with the blade, like up the pant leg? Is that what was that?
Well, no, that'd be high sticking for me. That's how high my stick would have to go.
Wiz, Jim knows nothing about hockey, so just walk him through it.
Okay.
Yeah. I just got him, you know, put the puck through his legs and made him play to an empty net. And so he was hard on me the next game. And then finally I was going in the corner and he doesn't like when little guys go in there because you know, we turn a little faster and slower. So he grabbed me by the back of the pants and he's so strong with one hand. He just lifted me up enough where just the tip of my toes were touching the ice and I couldn't get a grip anywhere. And he threw me from about the goal line to the boards. And then he finished me with another hit. And as I went down, he came down with 260 pounds on top of me and cross-checked me in the back. And I got up from that and I said, are we good yet? And he says, not yet. So I had to take a couple more from it. But I tell you, I wasn't trying to go through his legs the next time.
Just a reminder, if you'd like to connect online with Russ or Jimmy or engage with them on social media, find out how at thesuspendables.com.
You got a great story, Ray. First of all, when did the whole golf thing start for you? This is ironic. I would be talking to you about golf next. I got my ass handed to me by you. Me and Brad Jansen, who hockey guys would know, was a stick supplier dude. Brad, good guy. And you and Brendan Morrow whistled onto the first tee in Vegas. We were there at Shadow Creek. And of course, Rusty, as a bad negotiator, that I've been my whole life, you're not supposed to open up the negotiations, right? You let the other guy talk, right? So I'm sussing it out here. I'm going, all right, here's Lippy and what's his buddy's name, Brendan here. Okay. And they're supposed to be good. We heard all about him. I go, load up, boys, load up, whatever you want to play. I'm all in, you know, how good can you be? Well, I'm begging on the 11th tee going, okay, can we do a buyout? I've never been beaten so good. I've played golf for 45 freaking years, right? And I'm going, I'm just doing the stats here. This little prick is 2 under on an awfully unbelievable tough golf course. He's laughing his head off. Oh, get in the bunker. You know you're in tough when a guy says, get in the trap, okay? Jesus.
Well, I was fortunate. I played most of my career in a state or an area where you could play golf year round. You know, I was in San Jose for 6 years and in Florida for 4, Carolina for 5, you know, in Dallas, Phoenix. So, I had the opportunity to play year round. And then before I had kids, you know, my wife didn't really care if I went and played golf and,
or like you, though.
So I was just able to play a lot of golf growing up. And then, you know, you become friends with tour players over the years, and then you start playing with them, and then they start giving you just a little bit of tidbit here, a little something there. And then before you know it, you retire and you join Whisper Rock, and we have 35 touring pros out there that, that oh, cool. get their ass kicked by some of the amateurs who are at the club, because they're the college players who never made it, but they're extremely good in their own course. So, right now my handicap's up to a +3, and I'll go back to Whisper Rock and get an absolute beating for 2 or 3 months until my handicap comes, you know, back to zero where it should be. But, the course I play up here in Idaho, it's a little, I find it a little easier for me. So my handicap keeps going down, and as a +3 at Whisper Rock, you better be a tour player or you're gonna get your ass kicked. And that's usually what happens now.
So just for folks who aren't in the know, what plus fucking three means, excuse my language. Okay. Stevie, mark that. Okay. I said +3, leave the F bomb in, but forget the +3. so a plus three and a handicap. So if you're a zero, you're a zero. Just for the sake of keeping it uncomplicated, that means you're going to shoot par. Okay. Under the old differential system, it's in there. So zero's about par. Okay. So if you're a 3 handicap, okay. If someone says, what's your handicap? I'm a 3. Okay, that means they're really good. That means they're shooting 75, okay? If it's a, you know, it's par 72. When a guy says +3, okay, that means he went from a 3 to a 2 to a 1 to a 0. But let's not stop there. Let's go 1, 2, 3 the other way. So that means you're shooting 2 or 3 under par. What about you?
I know.
Yeah, and Jimmy used to be a plus three drinker.
I'm a 7, right? Focus. I'm a 7 standing on the tee with him going, okay, you're going to have to give me 2 aside. He goes, sure.
Okay. I said, you got it. What are we playing for?
Yeah, you got it, man. Talk about when you anyone talks about you and your great career, Wiz, what's always in that conversation is, and I don't know if this story keeps getting blown up more and more out of proportion, but that you did work in the Oilers dressing room with your brother. And I think Ryan Smith was around at that same time. And by the end of it, someone was telling me you were the guy who actually dressed Gretzky. You put his shin pads on, you put his shoulder pads on. Okay, you give him a little rub down before each game. I said, I know, I don't think so. But you did have a pretty, you do talk about it from time to time, and it's a pretty cool story about that experience you had as a stick boy with the Oilers.
Yeah. I mean, I was fortunate. My dad was their practice goalie for 30 years. And I've been in that locker room since I was about 10 or 11. And when I was 13, 14, 15, I used to work game nights, and Ryan Smith wasn't there yet. He came after I'd left, but my brother as well. So I was in there, and it was either me or Stevie Moss, Joey's older brother, younger brother, Stevie. And Wayne would come in, and he'd be one of us. It would probably be whoever was closest. Usually I was the one sniffing around. When 99 came in, I was like, hey, Spike, you know, what do you need? And he just looked at me and goes, I need 4 cut tonight or 5. And the beauty of back in the days, for those who don't know nowadays with the composite sticks, players took a lot of time and effort to torch their sticks, the curve. Russ would attest to this. They put a lot of time to the weight of the stick and where the curve was. And they would spend, you know, an hour doing their sticks. They'd spend some time in the morning and at night, but 99 would come in and he'd just say, I need 4 or 5. You just grab whatever 4 or 5 off the rack. The one that he used last, you just measure it with that, cut it off, leave it in his stall. He would tape them, and then once he's done taping them, you'd grab them, you'd take them out, put the baby powder on the blades.
Right, right.
It was said to help keep the snow off the blade, but he never used a stick long enough to get that much snow on it anyway. But and then you'd leave him one. And it didn't matter which one. He didn't need to flex them. He didn't need to look at the curve. I could have left him a broom with a 99 on the top. It wouldn't have mattered. But every now and then, I'd make the mistake of not leaving him one.
Uh-oh.
And I'd be on the bench handing out the pucks as they step on the ice. I'd throw a puck to each player as they get on, and I get a whack upside the head. And I look back, and it's the best player in the world walking out to warmups with no stick. And he just grab one and off he'd go. So that was my job before the game. And obviously my job after the game was to make sure he was hydrated properly with his Gatorade cup.
Was it always going to be hockey for you, Ray? I always ask this question of every guest because I'm curious. I want to know.
It's funny, you know, your parents always ask you, what do you be when you grow up? And it was always hockey player. Yes, always hockey player. And then they'd say, what if you don't make it hockey? And then you'd say something to appease them as a lawyer or a doctor, which we knew, anybody knew me in school, that wasn't going to happen. So when I got a little bit older, when hockey was, you know, a couple of times early in my career, when it wasn't going to work out, or I didn't think it was going to, I was probably going to go be a policeman like my father. And I know in today's world, you know, that's a scary thought with how the police are treated or thought of these days. And what I think it was a great profession. I'm very proud of my dad and his career that he had with the police department, and being around them and had the same kind of feel as a locker room and a camaraderie, you know, within there. So if hockey wasn't going to get any better for me earlier in my career, that's kind of the path I was going to go after that, which may or may not surprise some.
Ray, that's exactly what Jeff and I were going to do too, if we didn't make it. We used to, when we played for the Cougars, we used to ride around with the police officers in town. And our uncles were RCMP officers, staff sergeants, actually. And that was where we were kind of leaning if hockey didn't work out.
If I was a citizen, I would far rather get stopped by Ray Whitney than I would Jeff or Russ Cordell. Okay. I think Ray. No,
Ray would put you in the back seat. Jeff would put you in the trunk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Jeff would for sure.
Drive the neighborhood as fast as possible and take every corner at about 50 miles an hour. Bang your head off. Okay, don't do that again.
Yeah. That's enough. Yeah. You.
Please be better.
Yeah, please be better. The funny, the other thing is the how hilarious you are with the photobombing. Okay. And you must have done it a lot because I was looking at your Wikipedia today, and that comes up like right away, you know. Yeah. And anyone who knows you have seen that where a guy's doing an interview, Rusty.
Yeah.
And then Norton here, okay, goes by the guy like this with his head sideways. Hilarious shit. And then it became kind of a fan favorite thing, didn't it, in Carolina or something like that?
Yeah, it did. It was funny, my first year in Carolina, I was doing it, and I wasn't telling anybody about it. I just keep on doing it and doing it. And finally, Peter Laviolette was in the coach's room. They were watching, you know, the feed on the ice, and they're watching the interview. And finally, after two or three times, he says, "Hey, do you guys ever notice what Witt's doing out there in warm-up? He's not doing anything other than skating by the camera." And they kept going by. So now they're sitting there. Now they're watching all the pregame interviews on the bench because they're dying laughing. And so we were in LA now. This is about a month into it. Nobody knows I'm doing this yet. And we do the power play meeting in the morning after the morning skate. And then they're saying, "Hey, guys, in case you guys didn't know what else is going on out here in you know, warm-ups, now look at this guy prepared." And then it showed a whole about five or six games of me photobombing these guys back and forth. And then the whole place started laughing. And then I'd get really close, and then I'd do stuff where I'd try to come up from the bottom and then make faces on the side. And, you know, I tickle a guy between the legs with my stick as he's going, whatever I can do to make this guy uncomfortable. You know, a lot of times, especially in the old days, wrestle tests that where coaches were so hard, that means you're not ready for the game, and you're not, you know, you're supposed to be tough and mean and focused and all that. And that was just the way I was able to prepare for a game. You know, I didn't stretch before games. I watched Seinfeld until it was time to get dressed.
Shit.
I was able to be fun and have a good time and laugh until it was game time and the puck dropped. Because once the puck dropped, I was able to turn that off and turn the seriousness on. And then within the game, I'd have some fun while I'm at it. I mean, nowadays we have three timeouts in every period. And as long as the faceoff was going to be on our side of the red line, the linesman, they also dropped the puck on the dot that the faceoff's going to be at. And then they'd go and huddle at the penalty box and talk whatever they're doing about the girl in row five or
right
whatever. And I'd just get over and I'd grab the puck and throw it in the crowd. And they'd come out of their little huddle and they'd be like, "Where's the puck? Who has the puck?" And they'd be looking around at each other. And after about half of the game, they're starting to figure out what the hell is going on here? Where are all the pucks going? At that point, I probably throw in almost seven pucks in the crowd. And, you know, I do that just within the game as well. It's just, I think it's a game. And I think in the end, people have to realize you should have fun while you're doing it
yeah.
at every level. And Although we're getting paid, you are serious, but there are times where you can make some light of it and have some fun with it.
Right. There's so many fun memories of guys having fun and screwing around with each other. And we're all together for so many days and hours. And, you know, you're always with your teammate. They become like your family. And so somebody's got to keep the room loose and keep the guys loose, because not everybody's like that. Not every player can be like that. So there's always a couple on every team that keep the boys laughing, and being around so many good guys, it's just fun. I mean, it's just so much fun being around each other. In the old days, we probably got away with a lot more because of, you know, no social media and cameras and stuff, but we did some fun stuff. A lot of laughs.
That definitely changes the world now. Mm-hmm. Social media and cameras and things like that. But
yeah,
it was fun while I was in it. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. When we sit around at Gosser at the tree bar, and one guy will tell a funny story, and then it just starts going around and around, and everybody's waiting their turn to tell, you know, a funny story. And Ray, how much fun is that up there? And now we've got Coach Peyton up there telling stories and other guys, and it's just it's so much fun. And then all these other people sitting around listening are so envious because they've never heard of such a thing.
They're like Harry at the office never does that.
Jeff, I want you to think about some of the funniest shit that's happened in your career, Ray, because Jeff, we had him on, and it's just one prank after another. Okay. With sports with Jeff. Well, like, I don't know how he thinks of it, but it's drop dead funny. Rusty, I like the one, Ray, I like the one where a guy had a brand new car, like a new Cadillac back in the day. And Rusty, they kept taking his car key and just nicking it on the skate sharpener grinder,
every day,
a little bit each day. And the guy, it's like, who thinks of that? You know? And
then, oh, I know.
Yeah.
I mean, I got to be honest with you. I got a whole bunch of them.
Let's hear them, baby.
You know, I got upset once with the strength coach for some of the shit he made us do one day.
Right.
You know, it was pretty, I thought it was excessive. So after I showered and he was gone, he was out of the room. I waited quite a while. I went and he had a wood locker, and I went and I got a drill and some screws, and I took his insoles out and I screwed his shoes down to the floor of his locker and put this. So he went out the next day. He couldn't get his shoes off of his, out of his locker, cause I had screwed them down there. And I might've wrote a note that said F off while you're at it. You know, so doing shit like that. But probably the best one I did, and the one I had a hard time controlling myself with, is we're in Florida. It's the last game. We have, you know, it's a practice before the last game. We're at the practice facility. And my dad, being a policeman, had this sneak powder. They call it a sneak powder. It's used to catch people from stealing within a company. You know, it's a visible dust. They put it on money or put it on something that was getting stolen. And then when it gets activated by water, it turns bright purple. And you can't get it off for about a week. You know, you gotta douse your hands with bleach for a few hours, you know, to get it off. So I got in there nice and early when trainers got there, and I put this stuff in probably half a dozen guys' socks. You know, in Florida, we wear sandals to the rink. But Rob Niedermeyer, and him and I used to go out all the time. I did his whole outfit and everything, neck to neck down. So we practiced, and it was like half hour practice, 30 minutes. But I would see guys have a purple streak across their forehead because they must have got it on their hands and just wiped their forehead or something. And they got, and these guys are going, "Hey, what's going on? My hands are turning purple in practice." And I'm like, "Well," I said, I had those gloves. It's the dye. The dye is running from your gloves." Right. But meanwhile, I can't freaking skate in practice. I'm laughing at these guys with these purple streaks across the forehead. And then as soon as practice is over, I go because I know what's going to happen. I don't even shower. I just get out of my stuff. And I'm sure. But guys were coming off earlier than I thought they would. And a couple guys took their skates off and their socks are bright purple. And then they take their socks off and they're right up half calf. They're Barney Rubble or, you know, Barney the Bear or whatever, dinosaur. They're purple as purple can be. And then Niedermeyer came in. And he was purple from his neck down to his feet. And it was not last game of the season, next day. And there, obviously I was getting blamed, but Dino Cicerelli, who had just been injured, was hanging around. So I blamed him. nice but I one. Couldn't practice. I was laughing so hard, but it took these guys 3 or 4 days to get that purple off of them before. And I can't even explain to you how hard it was not to keep just die laughing the entire practice.
Sure.
Wiz, we had that in Montreal from Pat Burns, who was a cop.
Right.
And he did it to, put it on the toilet seat and Stefan Richer went in and sat down for a number two and came out with a big ring around his ass.
Oh yeah.
LaPerriere, our assistant coach, Patrick Wad, cut his tracksuit off at the knees. So he put it in his mask, his goalie mask. So he had the purple face for a week. Abernakis, Nicholas, what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, stuff like that is just what keeps it fun. I mean, yeah, I roomed with, everybody knows Scott Mellenby. He's a great human as well. And he was my roommate in Florida. And last shift of the first period in Montreal, he kind of catches an edge head first in the boards, you know, gives himself a concussion, knocks himself out. We go to Toronto right after the game. He's laying in bed most of the day. We play the next night. We're time for us to leave. He didn't play, obviously. So I helped him with his bags and helped take him stuff. But his bag, when he got back to Toronto or back to Florida, his wife's helping him unpack. And in his bag, he has the Toronto area phone book, yellow pages. He has the iron. He has all the soap and towels. I absolutely stuffed everything I could in his bag. He had no idea. And his wife comes up and goes, why do you have an iron in the bag? Like, well, I don't know who paid the bill for that, for new iron and stuff like that. But man, I love doing shit like that. It's just, it keeps the game fun.
Oh, it's the best. It's the best. Stanley Cup, man. In 2006, Ray, is that right? I got the year right. Yeah. Against the Oilers. Yeah. What a treat. And I know your dad, I love your dad. Floyd, he's just the best. And the way he got to be a goaltender, as I understand, a practice goaltender, is they needed a guy. He happened to be around, and he stepped in net and was taking pucks left and right and just got absolutely freaking tattooed. And they thought he'll never do that again. And he pulled his mask down and goes, that was great. Let's keep doing it. Wasn't that how it started for your dad doing that?
Yeah. I think originally he pulled over a guy by the name of Kirk Brackenbury. And
sure, I remember that.
Pulled him over for speeding or for something, and you know, didn't give him a ticket, was just talking to him. And believe it or not, from that stop, they became friends. And, you know, maybe Brack gave him some tickets to hockey. I don't know how it went from there, but it turned out that he found out my dad was a goalie, and the team was on the road, so the spare guys needed somebody to shoot at. So Brackenbury called my dad and was, hey, do you want to just, we'll take some shots on you while we're injured guys? And it went from there to, now, when one of the older guys went down, we just call, this guy's been skating with us. So it went from that to now he's skating with the practice for the regulars. And then it became that Grant Fear very rarely practiced in the years that he was playing 70 games, 68 games a year. He never practiced. You know, he'd come out for the morning skates and just that's how he stayed. So they needed another goalie to be in there. And my dad was pretty good for the confidence of the Oilers. He tributes a lot of their success in the 80s for, you know, to him. But what it was, like you said, he had a big set of balls on him and he would take those one timers from the hash marks. He'd take them off the collarbone and he would take them. He didn't care where it hit him. And, they're actually in West Edmonton Mall skating in front of the fans. And, Lee Foglin comes in top of the circle or just above and takes that little high slapper and raises up, hits my dad right in the forehead. Jesus. Back before the mask. He had just the helmet on, sliced him open across the forehead, the pressure cut. And he's got blood streaming down his face and he's still in there. And he's just kind of trying to blink through the blood. He's still trying to stop shots. And they had to stop the drill and say, Floyd, you got to go. You got to go. He took his helmet off. He's got blood everywhere. Like, we can't have the fans seeing this right now. So he had to go get stitched up. But I'll give my dad credit, man. He's a tough son of a bitch and he'll stick his nose in there and take whatever you have to offer. So
that's great.
And from there, you know, there he became part of their team and, to the point where he got a ring for cup number 4 and a ring for cup number 5. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
I was just going to ask if they did that. That's great.
He's very proud of his days with the Oilers and I'm very proud of him for as long he did that and how he was able to get my brother and I into that locker room and be a part of, to me, the best team has ever played.
When the whistle blew and you won, I'm sure your dad was down there for that. And I know this wonderful relationship you had with him, but talk to us about that when you finally got a Stanley Cup.
You know, I'd been in the league 15 years and I turned pro at 19. So I've been pro for 15 years and I thought I was going to win the cup the previous year, my previous year in Detroit. We won the President's Trophy and we ended up losing in second round to Calgary. And, you know, then the lockout happened and then I got bought out from that contract and signed with Carolina. And we were ranked 30th and 29th in the two major hockey, you know, hockey news and the sporting news. So we weren't expected to do a lot of great things. And then here we are in game 7 and we win. And, you know, I remember thinking, I jumped and hugged Mark Recchi. We were still on the bench because we weren't good enough to be on the ice in the last minute. And, you know, we went jumping on the ice and do the whole, you know, around the players and the goaltenders and stuff. And then after the handshake was over, the Carolina Hurricanes are the year we won were very bullish on family. And we were a very tight group on and off the ice with all our wives, kids, everybody. And that went from the GM all the way down to the trainer. So they opened up the end gates, you know, the cup was coming out. And after the cup came out, they brought out all these dividers, these stanchions to make so everybody have all the wives and family, kids, parents, everybody was on the ice. And since then they made a rule that you can't have people on the ice anymore. They limited how many you could have. Cause we had 200 family members on the ice or even more. And so my mom and dad, my brother, my best friend from back home was on the ice with us, my sister-in-law. So we had, my family's down on the ice. So right after you win, you do all the hugging, you do the lap around the ice with the cup and then seeing your family on the ice with you, that's when there's a pretty good hug down there from my parents and I, and people always credit their dads, but, people, I think I realize that your mothers have just as much of an impact on your career and your life as your father. So I was pretty excited to have both mom and dad down there on the ice with me.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. No kidding, man. I love those stories. I see you've played for 31 of the 32 teams, Ray, that are in the NHL. I was just going down the list. Like you and Koff, I know. And I always cracked a joke with Koff when their kid said, I wanted to go out as my dad for Halloween as a hockey player, it cost him $1,500 in jerseys. Okay. Cause the kid had to keep peeling one off with the other one. Of all those teams and the coaches you had, Ray, there's gotta be a funny story too. I mean, Brophy was unbelievable. Of the guys you played with and the prankster that you are, there's gotta be one or two good stories about you and a coach, you and coaches.
Yeah. I mean, when you play on 8 teams total, you know, one of two things. It's either I tell everybody it's because everybody wanted me. but in reality, it's, you know, when you're a small guy and you're pretty opinionated and strong type A kind of personality, that a lot of time clashes with coaches. So coaches and I didn't always see eye to eye. In fact, a lot of them and I didn't because when I got in shit from a coach and I would take it. But then if I thought they were wrong, I would give it back. And coaches that I found, they don't like getting criticism coming back at them. So, but one of the best ones was Peter Laviolette. It was a great coach for me. I enjoyed him and he loved my antics. And one day we're in the playoffs, we're in the finals. And Aaron Ward, he had these pictures after we beat Montreal in game 6. And it's me and Laviolette kind of hugging on by the bench. And everywhere you turned in the corner in the locker room, there was this picture of Lavi and I hugging, right? And so, you know, whatever it was, you know, he was trying to make something out of it. But I knew he was going to do that. One of the teammates tipped me off to it. So I went to Laviolette early that morning and I said, hey, this is what's going to happen. We're going to see these pictures everywhere. He goes, okay, what do you want to do? And he goes, I got a better idea. After we beat New Jersey, we all went to rush their goaltender and congratulate him. And Aaron Ward was the only one still on the bench, high-fiving and hugging both the coaches while nobody else was there. And I just happened to be, you know, when I hugged him, I just happened to be around everybody. And so he knew these pictures were going to be on there and he played it. And then in our team meeting before we get going to play Buffalo, you know, we're going over every player and their stats and what they're going to do. He pretends he's really mad. And what he does is he's pissed off that the picture looked like I wasn't really hugging him, that he was just hugging me. And he goes, and that's not acceptable. You know, Ray, then you pretend to get mad at me. I'm pissed off at you for this. You embarrassed me in public because you didn't hug back. And it looks like I'm just hugging you. And he goes, if I want love, this is what I want. And he had a video ready. And the video was just with Aaron Ward running around hugging all the coaches by himself. Just because he had to be the last guy to get off the bench, you know. So it was fun to have a coach. We kind of gave it back to Karen Ward. He was so mad about it, but it was fun to have a coach who liked to play those games with you.
Yep.
And love to have a good time. And those are kind of rare and far between now. I think Coach Cooper in Tampa has a great personality and gets along with their players really well, which I think is a big factor on a successful coach nowadays. But the other ones, most of those other ones, I just pissed them off more than anything, Jimmy. That's about all
I did. I know how you feel.
Well, congrats, man. I'm not blowing smoke when I say it, but when you read about you and your career and everything you've done and everything, it gets close to, and you want to stand, it gets close to sort of Hall of Fame consideration, man. You know, you got those two 1,000s, you know, points and game.
Yeah, those two 1,000s are hard to get. Would I consider myself a Hall of Fame? Well, I wouldn't compare it to most of the people in there. You know, there's some that numbers-wise are going to be, you could say numbers-wise I could be in there, but I don't think I should ever be in the Hall of Fame before a guy who paved the way for every small player to play in a very tough era, and that is Theron Fleury. He's one of the guys I think is one of the best players to ever play the game, and he's the one who paved the way for every small guy in the 90s to have that opportunity to play, and I think he's one of the best competitors and one of the best small players to ever play the game. And there's some people in there that right now that I think should be behind him. Mm-hmm. So there are some great players I think should be in there. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Roenick's got 500 plus goals. It's hard for anybody who has 500 goals not to be in there. But eventually Jungle, they're going to run out of players and I'm going to fall down the list and I'll be about 90 years old. And then you never know.
Well, yeah. Gretz said you should be in there. So.
Well, then that's the gospel to me. If he says it, I believe it.
Yeah, Gretz said on our show, didn't he?
Absolutely, he did.
Yeah. He talked about the Hall of Fame and how it's changed. And
it has changed.
But he gave your name up as an example.
Well, yeah, it is nice to have the best of all time in your corner, that's for sure.
Yeah. Neil Broughton's another guy that was a smaller player that I think should be in the Hall of Fame. I've said that many times. I think he was the first U.S. player to get 100 points. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yeah, he was a heck of a player for sure.
Oh, yeah. And then converted to a defensive player and still played great.
Well, Dennis Savard got in there. He's small. I mean, he might.
Savvy's in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's probably great arguments for a lot of people who are in and some who are out arguments both ways for some who are in and out. So how it ever goes, gets to be, I don't know. I'm just thankful I got the opportunity to play in the league as long as I did with some great people, and I'm still in there now and working with great people. It's funny, when you're a player for the whole time, you learn to fight with the NHL or be part of the player association, which you're supposed to, but when you get into the other side of the league, you realize how great of a team it is on the other side as well, and it's just fun for me to be on both sides and have an opportunity to see both sides of the game and both sides of you know, the players battling the NHL, and you understand now from both sides kind of where everything stands. And it's really interesting, and I'm very thankful I've had the opportunity to do both.
Well, you're a huge asset for them, so they're probably more thankful of you working for them than the other way around. But it's great to have players like yourself that have they're still involved in the game and help out the executives that aren't, never played the game and better understand it. Because coming from a player, it means so much more than some guy who's a lawyer and didn't play the game, doesn't understand the locker room and the mentality and how things work. So it's good to have players like yourself involved in the game.
For sure.
That's enough of this love affair. Can we stop now? Can we wrap this? We're going to sing Kumbaya, everybody. Ray, great having you on, man. Yeah, I really appreciate it. You're just a fantastic guy, and I love the fact I call you a friend from way back when we met, and good luck with everything. And where are you living now? So you're Idaho in the summer, and then where are you off to?
Well, a place called Scottsdale down in Arizona, so it kind of helps the golf game.
There we go.
Nice. Okay.
Go figure. Yeah, I'm in Michigan, Jim. That's right.
Good. I go to Alaska, Jim. I fish.
Work out my short game. Okay. Take it easy, Witz. Thanks a lot, Matt, for coming on this.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Anytime.
The Suspendables is a weekly podcast series featuring former NHLer Russ Courtnell and host Jim Jerome. Join us for new episodes available each Wednesday morning. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We invite you to subscribe and review or share the show with your friends and followers. Check out our website today, thesuspendables.com.